We are going to be in 2 Samuel chapter 14 tonight. Last week we began this last major narrative section in 2 Samuel. This stretches from chapter 13 really all the way through chapter 20. The story concerning Absalom really occupies 13 to 19, and then chapter 20 is some additional fallout as a result of the almost, but not in the end, attempted coup to remove David from his throne. Last week, I had hoped that we might cover two chapters because chapters 13 and 14 are really preparatory for what begins to happen in chapter 15 with this military conspiracy and coup to remove David. But we didn't make it that far, so we're going to re-enter the text tonight in chapter 14. Before we read chapter 14, just by way of kind of reacquainting ourselves with where we are, remember that David has two sons that are important in this story. Amnon, his eldest, is a man who is clearly a man without integrity, a man of no honor. He is vile. He is perverse. He has a lustful infatuation with his half-sister Tamar. She perhaps is unaware of his desire for her, because he is able, through consultation with his cousin Jonadab, to lure her into his house alone, to lock the doors, and to forcibly rape her, despite her pleas and protests against that act of violence, which was not only rape, but was also an incestuous act of sexual aggression. Amnon, after he rapes Tamar, is immediately disgusted by her. He throws her out of the house, bars the door behind her, treats her with even greater shame, if that were even possible in our Western minds. We're trying to wrap our minds around this, right? But this is even worse than what he originally did, she says. And she tears her garment, signifying her virginity, and goes about mourning and weeping. Her brother Absalom is obviously also a half-brother to Amnon, and Absalom takes her into his home. He holds his peace, and he appears to wait for their father David to do something about this great transgression. And David is made aware of the situation, and this is one of the most disgusting and perplexing parts of the story. How could David know about this and not do something about it? Just remember that this is David, who as a young man, probably still in his late teens, runs, not walks, runs onto the field of battle to fight against a giant standing 9 feet at least tall when all of the rest of the Israelites are paralyzed with fear. This is David, who runs after lions and bears and smashes them in the head with clubs, right, in order to reclaim a sheep or a lamb that may in fact already be dead. This is David, who in 1 Samuel chapter 25 was prepared to destroy an entire estate. And by estate, I don't mean the property. I mean the people of Nabal's household. He was ready to murder all of them because of an insult from this fool. And this is David now, seemingly paralyzed, unable to act in any decisive way. He is appalled by what Amnon has done. He is angry, but he does not take any action. And that is failure. That is so deeply wrong. I make a point of not ever making movie references, unless it's The Sound of Music, because over the years I found that no one was offended if I used The Sound of Music, right? And I'm appalled by what some movies are used in the pulpits. But I'm not in the pulpit tonight. I'm standing on the floor, so maybe this will be okay. Maybe this won't get me in trouble. If you've seen the movie The Patriot, which some of you may not have seen, a depiction of a family during the American Revolutionary War, a father who had fought in the French Indian Wars and had been a man of great bloodshed, and finds himself in the latter years of his life paralyzed with guilt for his past transgressions. He is unable to bring himself to participate in the events leading up to the war. He continues to plead for peace, for reconciliation, for anything that can avoid bloodshed. Understandably, he doesn't want to be involved in that. However, his sons are not so passive, and it ultimately costs him the life of some of his children. At one point in the movie, there is this very powerful scene where his son is dead, his family is falling apart, and he is clearly racked with guilt and with shame. And his sister-in-law says to him, "You have done nothing of which you should be ashamed." And he responds very powerfully, "I have done nothing, and for that I am ashamed." Now that is a great illustration of the crisis in this story. That's David. He is paralyzed by perhaps the guilt of his past transgressions. The fact that he has been a man of bloodshed, and that, most recently in the text at least, the blood that he has shed has been innocent blood. And he has lost all moral authority in his home, and it is getting worse. And so David, after 2 years, still has not done anything to address this crime. And finally, Absalom has enough. He has a party at the time of sheep shearing, a great festival, a time of celebration. And he invites all of the king's sons to come. He originally invites David as well, pleads with David, "Oh, Dad, come out with us to the party." I'm reading between the lines here. I think David is only invited because Absalom knows he will refuse. And in David's refusal, Absalom will gain the leverage to ensure that the crown prince is there. Amnon is David's oldest. He is presumably the heir to the throne at this point. And yet, surely Amnon is not so foolish as to go outside of the camp, the capital rather, out into a primitive location, a remote location, with the half-brother whose sister he raped, right? Regardless, Absalom says, "Well, Dad, if you won't go, send Amnon. Make sure that my brother, the prince, is there." And indeed he is. And at the signal, Absalom's men rise up and they kill Amnon. Couldn't have happened to a nicer person, right? Absalom then flees. He goes into exile. Absalom was the grandson, or the son and grandson of the royal family of Geshur. His mother was the princess of Geshur. His grandfather was the king. And he goes there and he remains there for 3 years. And that is where we left off last week. Chapter 13, verse 39, it ends, "The spirit of the king longed to go out to Absalom because he was comforted about Amnon since he was dead." And that speaks of, sadly, moral cowardice. He's thankful that Absalom did what he himself was unable or unwilling to do. And yet, he is content to leave Absalom in exile for his crime. Chapter 14. "Now Joab, the son of Zeruiah, knew that the king's heart went out to Absalom. And Joab sent to Tekoa and brought from there a wise woman and said to her, 'Pretend to be a mourner and put on mourning garments. Do not anoint yourself with oil, but behave like a woman who has been mourning many days for the dead. Go to the king and speak thus to him.' So Joab put the words in her mouth. When the woman of Tekoa came to the king, she fell on her face to the ground and paid homage and said, 'Save me, O king.' And the king said to her, 'What is your trouble?' She answered, 'Alas, I am a widow. My husband is dead. And your servant had 2 sons, and they quarreled with one another in the field. There was no one to separate them, and one struck the other and killed him. And now the whole clan has risen against your servant, and they say, Give up the man who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed. And so they would destroy the heir also. Thus they would quench my coal that is left and leave to my husband neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth.' Then the king said to the woman, 'Go to your house and I will give orders concerning you.' And the woman of Tekoa said to the king, 'On me be the guilt, my lord the king, and on my father's house let the king and his throne be guiltless.' The king said, 'If anyone says anything to you, bring him to me, and he shall never touch you again.' Then she said, 'Please let the king invoke Yahweh, your God, that the avenger of blood kill no more and my son be not destroyed.' He said, 'As Yahweh lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground.' Then the woman said, "Please let your servant speak a word to my lord the king." He said, "Speak." And the woman said, "Why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God? For in giving this decision, the king convicts himself, inasmuch as the king does not bring his banished one home again. We must all die. We are like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. But God will not take away life, and he devises means so that the banished one may not remain an outcast. Now I have come to say this to my lord the king, because the people have made me afraid. And your servant thought, 'I will speak to the king. It may be that the king will perform the request of his servant, for the king will hear and deliver his servant from the hand of the man who would destroy me and my son together from the heritage of God.' And your servant thought, 'The word of my lord the king will set me at rest, for my lord the king is like the angel of God to discern good and evil. Yahweh your God be with you.' Then the king answered the woman, 'Do not hide from me anything I ask you.' And the woman said, 'Let my lord the king speak.' The king said, 'Is the hand of Joab with you in all this?' The woman answered and said, 'As surely as you live, my lord the king, one cannot turn to the right hand or to the left from anything that my lord the king has said. It was your servant Joab who commanded me. It was he who put all these words in the mouth of your servant. In order to change the course of things, your servant Joab did this. But my lord has wisdom, like the wisdom of the angel of God, to know all things that are on the earth.' Then the king said to Joab, 'Behold, now I grant this. Go, bring back the young man Absalom.' And Joab fell on his face to the ground and paid homage and blessed the king. And Joab said, 'Today your servant knows that I have found favor in your sight, my lord the king, in that the king has granted the request of his servant.' So Joab arose and went to Geshur and brought Absalom to Jerusalem. And the king said, 'Let him dwell apart in his own house. He is not to come into my presence.' So Absalom lived apart in his own house and did not come into the king's presence." Now in all Israel, there was no one so much to be praised for his handsome appearance as Absalom. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. And when he cut the hair of his head, for at the end of every year he used to cut it, when it was heavy on him, he cut it. He weighed the hair of his head 200 shekels by the king's weight. There were born to Absalom 3 sons and 1 daughter, whose name was Tamar. She was a beautiful woman. So Absalom lived 2 full years in Jerusalem without coming into the king's presence. Then Absalom sent for Joab to send him to the king, but Joab would not come to him. And he sent a second time, but Joab would not come. Then he said to his servants, "See, Joab's field is next to mine, and he has barley there. Go and set it on fire." So Absalom's servants set the field on fire. Then Joab arose and went to Absalom at his house and said to him, "Why have your servants set my field on fire?" Absalom answered Joab, "Because I sent word to you, 'Come here, that I may send you to the king,' to ask, why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me to be there still. Now therefore, let me go into the presence of the king, and if there is guilt in me, let him put me to death." And Joab went to the king and told him, and he summoned Absalom. So he came to the king and bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king. And the king kissed Absalom. This is just horrible. I mean, it goes from perverse, immoral, violent, wicked, to just this weak, cowardly, indecisive way that David is not dealing with this situation. Now, one of the things I need to emphasize tonight that we tried to emphasize last week is, where is Christ in all of this? Well, you are not going to find David as a Christ character in this part of the story. Arguably, we will see that later, right? But in this part of the story, David is not the Christ character. Neither is Absalom. There is no Christ character in this story. Where you see Christ in this part of the story is the desperate need for Christ. Because Christ alone can do what no one else in the story seems to be able to do. Christ alone can balance mercy and justice. Christ alone can judge with righteous judgment. The man after God's own heart is unable to perfectly execute justice. And if you can't get it from David, you're not likely to get it anywhere else. The hope that we have is not in David, it is in the Son of David. Not Amnon and not Absalom, but in Christ. And you need to see the way in which this part of the story points us to that need that we have for Jesus and for an eschatological king rather than a typological king. Now, that being said, I think we make a mistake if we're reading the Old Testament and expecting to find a type of Christ or a picture of Christ in every line. That's not the right way to read the Bible. All of the Old Testament points us ahead to Jesus, but it does so in different ways. It's not always in some kind of direct typology or analogy. The other thing to remember is that we're in the middle, or at the beginning still, of a very large story. We divide this up into chapters to make it easier to find our way around. But again, this story stretches from chapter 13 to chapter 19 or 20, and we need to recognize that that's the unit of narrative that we're working with. Now, here in chapter 14, Joab knows, verse 1, that David's heart goes out to Absalom. One, just as an aside, I'm not going to belabor this point or develop it much, although maybe we could. Do you notice how David is referred to in this chapter over and over? Not as David. I'll just point that out. You can take from that what you will, right? The king. And he is not much better than any other human king in terms of his leadership in this chapter. Joab knows that David longs for Absalom. Now, one of the things that the text does not tell us, but that I would suspect might be true, is that Joab has met with Absalom during this time of exile. He has been in Geshur for 3 years. It has been 5 years at this point since Amnon raped Tamar. And that's a long time. I suspect Geshur is not a long way off. It's not like this is crossing the seas to visit another country. I suspect that Joab, in the course of his duties, has found his way down to Geshur perhaps more than once. After all, they are allied to David and Israel by marriage. So this would be a peaceful and diplomatic visit. Joab and Absalom are a lot alike. They are very similar in the way that they decisively and in a violent way deal with injustice as they perceive it. That doesn't mean that they're going to be allies throughout this story, because the time is going to come where Joab is going to have to choose sides and he will choose David over Absalom. But in terms of their personalities, perhaps, in terms of their leadership, in terms of the initiative they take, they are both in stark contrast to David's weakness and indecisiveness. So Joab knows that David really loves Absalom. He longs for Absalom. He appreciates, oddly enough, what Absalom has done. Absalom has solved the unsolvable problem. You know, David, for 2 years, has been wondering, what do we do with Amnon? He ought to die, but he's the crown prince, and can I really put my son to death for doing something that you know, arguably is the same thing that I did? If anything, David had more guilt than Amnon did, because Amnon has committed a capital crime, obviously, incest and rape. These are capital crimes, but David commits capital crimes as well. He commits adultery with his neighbor's wife, and he murders not only Uriah, but other men in the process as well. So David is thankful that Absalom has kind of solved this problem. But do you notice the assumption of chapter 14 is that Absalom's exile is comparable to being in a city of refuge? Did you see that? That we see that from the wise woman of Tekoa's little story, right? And remember, Joab gives her this story. So she sets up this scenario in which the only thing that is keeping her son alive right now would be a city of refuge. She doesn't mention the city of refuge, but she mentions the one who would pursue you to a city of refuge. She mentions the avenger of blood. So we'll deal with that in just a second. Absalom's exile is being viewed by David as essentially a condition like one who is in the city of refuge. And the city of refuge was no protection for a murderer. But the city of refuge was protection for someone who is guilty of manslaughter. And so that's the way that David has kind of, by default, that's the position he's adopted. Is to say, well, you know, Absalom took the life of someone he shouldn't have taken, but there were mitigating circumstances. There were extenuating circumstances, and therefore, he is not going to be executed, but he is going to be placed in exile. Now, I'm not saying that David has kind of officially decreed that. I think that this is just David's passivity, but perhaps in David's mind, that's how he's rationalized it. And that would explain then, why does Joab create the scenario that he does? The scenarios are not much alike except for that city of refuge point of connection. So Joab retrieves this wise woman from Tekoa. And he says, here's what I want you to do. I want you to dress as if you're a mourner. I want you to, to get into the character. And then I'm going to give you this scenario, give you this story, and I want you to go to the king. And so she plays the role. I mean, she plays it to the hilt. She continues to play the role until David actually catches her, right? Even after she turns the table and makes the application, well, isn't this kind of like what you're doing with Absalom? Isn't there a little bit of hypocrisy here? She's still in character. And it's only then that David realizes it. Verse 4, she comes to David, bows herself, you know, prostrates herself on the ground. Save me, O king. And she tells this story. She says, I'm a widow, and I had two sons. And they got into an argument, and it escalated, and one of them killed the other one. It was very sad, very sad. But now, all the people in our clan, all of the broader family unit, they are rightly calling for the blood of the murderer. They're saying his life is forfeit. And the avenger of blood is going to pursue. Now, why isn't the son already dead? Well, in the scenario, obviously this is actually hypothetical, but in the scenario, it's because he's in the city of refuge. That's the only hope that he has. That's the only way that he can survive. And what she says in verse 7 is, they desire to destroy the heir and quench my coal that is left, and leave to my husband neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth. Right? This is going to blot out our entire family line, and so I need help. Well, initially, David seems willing to do something, but maybe not willing to get very explicitly involved. Verse 8, he says, go to your house, and I will give orders concerning you. Well, that's fairly vague. And if, in fact, your son's life were hanging in the balance, I could understand wanting a little more explicit hope. And so verse 9, she says, let the guilt be on me. Let it be on my father's house. I don't want to put the blame, the guilt of any injustice upon you. And the king said, verse 10, if anyone says anything to you, bring him to me. He shall never touch you again. Who would blame the woman for some injustice in this? It would be the clan, which has the right of vengeance. They have the right to. Remember, this is judicial vengeance. This is not revenge. This is a judicial act provided by the law of Moses that says in the case of a murder like this, you don't have a standing police force, right? You don't have a criminal court system in the same way that we think of it today. There is a court system. There is a judicial process. But it would be the responsibility of the clan to appoint an avenger of blood to go and take the murderer's life. And this would be a legal proceeding, but it would be executed by the family, essentially. And then verse 11, she said, please let the king invoke Yahweh your God. Notice that twice she refers to him as Yahweh your God, not my God. Please let the king invoke Yahweh your God, that the avenger of blood kill no more and my son be not destroyed. So that's the issue. And unless I'm misreading the text, this is where the two stories converge. There's not a lot of similarity otherwise. I mean, admittedly, you've got two brothers who are in a conflict and one of them kills the other one, right? But that's a fairly small point of similarity. The real issue here is whether that boy is going to be pardoned so that he can leave the city safely. That's the question. The brother, now again, the fictional brother, the brother who killed his brother cannot leave the city of refuge or the avenger of blood will kill him, right? And now the question is, will you pardon my son? Will you stay the hand of the avenger of blood? Will you pronounce judgment so that his life will not be forfeit? Maybe if this were an actual scenario, the clan would be saying he doesn't even belong in the city of refuge because he committed murder, not manslaughter. Maybe that would be the argument, right? Well, that's the very question with Absalom. How do we categorize what Absalom did? Because let's just be honest about something. Amnon needed killing, right? Certain people do. The Bible says that certain people do, right? Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made he man, right? So there in Genesis chapter 9, verses 5 and 6, we say, all right, murderers' lives are forfeit. Well, that's the very question. Is Absalom guilty of murder? Or is Absalom acting as the avenger of blood, executing sentence on a man who also committed a capital crime, and that is an incestuous rape? That's the real question. And that's the scenario that Joab puts into her mouth, that she proffers to David. Is my son a murderer who must die, or is he a manslayer who must remain in a city of refuge, or will you pardon him so that he can be released? And by the way, David has the right to do this. There might be some questions in somebody's mind about this. Would this be an act of injustice? The answer is no, right? We have this in our judicial system, by the way, even though we think sometimes it might be exercised in an unjust manner, right? But it can be a legal injustice in those cases. Presidential pardons just work at the pleasure of the president. The president can say, go free. He can pardon anyone he chooses to pardon. We might look at the use of those powers and say that's really unjust, but something can be legal and yet be unjust, right? David has the discretion in this case not to execute full sentence against the offender. And remember, that's the very thing that God did with him. God pardons David. He's the only one who can, in fact, pardon David. Well, when David takes the name of Yahweh, verse 11, in his mouth, he makes this oath and says, as Yahweh lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground. What is he saying? He's saying he will, in fact, be pardoned. And the implication is not only that he will be, adjudicated as a manslayer and stay in the city of refuge, he will not have to remain in the city of refuge. He will not, his life will not be in jeopardy from the avenger of blood. If that's not what he's saying, then what the woman says next doesn't make any sense. Okay, go ahead.
Seems like God is being left out of this.
Do you think? Which I think is why he's called king the whole time instead of David. Yeah, keep going.
Well, there's a place for the imprecatory prayer, and here it is. And
absolutely.
In the sense that God would do justice and in his appointed way, and everybody's guiltless.
Yeah, exactly. Then nobody's got anything to worry about, right? Yeah. No, there's no. This is why we say this story just keeps getting worse and worse. Where is the Lord in this picture? Nowhere to be found, right? This is God in the shadows. So the Lord is invoked in this pardon, essentially. And then the woman kind of turns the tables on David. Now, she's still in character. But she says, why have you planned such a thing against the people of God? For in giving this decision, the king convicts himself. Inasmuch as the king does not bring his banished one home again. Again, if David is not offering to pardon her son and bring him out of the city of refuge, the analogy falls apart, right? The only way in which she can claim that David is acting hypocritically here is if, in fact, the judgment that he's just given is, in this case, given the extenuating circumstances, the brother should be set free. And she says, but aren't you doing just the opposite with your banished one? Verse 14, we must all die. We are like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. But God will not take away life, and he devises means so that the banished one will not remain an outcast. I don't think that that's true, by the way. I don't think that she is speaking faithfully there. Right? There might be an accommodative sense or some way that you can kind of crowbar that into a scenario where you say, well, it kind of, sort of. But in the way that she's using that statement here, that's not correct from my standpoint. Remember, the Bible is an accurate record, including of lies. including a false idea. It accurately records the things that Satan says. And what's her basic argument here? Her basic argument in verse 14 is that God is against upholding justice against a violent person. That's essentially what she's saying. God does not want life to be taken, and he devises means to regather his exiles, whether man is faithful in that effort or not. That's kind of a touchy-feely whatever. That's just not true, right? Verse 15, "Now I have come to say this to my lord the king, because the people have made me afraid, and your servant thought, 'I will speak to the king. It may be that the king will perform the request of his servant, for the king will hear and deliver his servant from the hand of the man who would destroy me and my son together from the heritage of God.' And I thought, 'Surely this is what the king will do.'" She's flattering him, right? "I know that you're so wise. You're like an angel of God to be able to discern good and evil. Yahweh, your God, be with you." I actually wonder whether this wise woman of Tekoa is a believer in Yahweh at all. Maybe she's saying Yahweh, your God, out in just kind of deference in the presence of the king. Or maybe she's saying it because she knows she's lying. Like the whole thing is a sham. I don't know. I don't have a position on that one way or the other. It's fascinating to me, the way that she is seeking to manipulate David. Now that's the point. When she gets to the flattery, that's the point that apparently David, his warning system goes off. And he says, "Tell me the truth. Did Joab put you up to this?" Now, read between the lines here. This is not hard. How would he know that it was Joab? He would know because Joab has already talked to him about this. And in fact, that's virtually confirmed when the king speaks to Joab. Verse 22, "Joab fell on his face to the ground, paid homage, and blessed the king. And Joab said, 'Today your servant knows that I have found favor in your sight, my lord the king, in that the king has granted the request of his servant.'" He's talking about himself. "This was my request, and it's been Joab's request for the last 3 years at least that Absalom has been gone. Joab has been wanting to bring Absalom home. Why? Well, because Joab doesn't believe that Absalom did anything wrong. He killed somebody that needed to be killed, and Joab has, previous to this and subsequent to this, shown a tremendous willingness to kill people that he thinks ought to be killed, whether David's willing to do it or not. The next example of that in David and Joab's life is going to be fascinating. David is going to give explicit orders to Joab, "Don't kill that person." And Joab's going to say, "He needs killing, and David's not willing to do what needs to be done. I will kill him. But if you don't know who I'm talking about, you need to read the rest of the story." So Joab has talked to David about this before. Joab has made this request before. That request has been falling on deaf ears. What that tells me is that David has had opportunities to make a decision about this, right? It's not to endorse making a wrong decision. It's not to suggest that you ought to make a hasty decision. But how do you let this thing drag on? How do you let Amnon go unpunished for 2 years? How do you let Absalom remain in exile without any formal acknowledgement or formal adjudication of his case for 3 years? That's insane. And so finally, the king says, verse 24, "Go get Absalom, but don't bring him to me. Let him dwell apart in his own house. He has not come into my presence." Now, why? That's the question you need to be thinking. Why? And let me tell you what's not the reason. It's not because David is angry with Absalom. It's not because David hates Absalom. It's not because David, kind of like in the situation with Amnon, is just appalled by what Absalom has done and just can't bring himself to do anything about it. It's because David is afraid of appearing soft. Or losing face.
He's embarrassed.
He's embarrassed. One of his sons raped his sister, and another son killed that son. The whole situation is a mess. The whole situation is a shame. And David is trying to hold all of it at arm's length. But we know that David longs for Absalom. David is thankful for what Absalom did. This is a PR move. That's all it is. It is not convenient, it is not expedient for David to be seen in close communion with Absalom, because Absalom killed the crown prince. Now, a sidebar piece of information jumps into the text at this point, which is going to factor into chapter 15. Absalom is a stud. I mean, he is a handsome, impressive, compelling person. And we're going to see he is a charmer in chapter 15. He has the ability to win the hearts of men. And so when I say charmer, I don't mean, you know, he's flattering them or buttering them up. He's a leader at a time when David is not a leader. So physically impressive, this long hair that will eventually be his undoing. He has three sons and one daughter. We don't know when she's born. We don't know if she's named after the fact. But we know that his daughter's name is Tamar. This is the love that Absalom has for his sister, whom he is maintaining and keeping in her shame for the rest of her life. So, 2 years, nothing's done about Amnon, and Absalom kills him. 3 years, Absalom stays in Geshur, nothing is done. Finally, he's brought home through Joab's conniving. 2 more years, verse 28. Absalom lived 2 full years in Jerusalem without coming into the king's presence. But he was just glad to be home, right? No. No. This is adding insult to injury. This is galling. Absalom does not believe he did anything wrong. Notice what he says in verse 32. It would be better for me to be in Geshur still. Let me go into the presence of the king, and if there is guilt in me, let him put me to death. If I'm an evildoer, take me out, but don't leave me in limbo. Absalom is being disrespected. He is the son that is not acknowledged because he's the only son that had, now we're thinking in his mind here, right? He's the only son that had the honor to do what needed to be done. Every one of the sons in David's house should have been willing to do what Absalom did. Only Absalom did it. Nobody did it. It was David's job. David didn't do it. Absalom has acted from his standpoint with honor and integrity, and now he is being dishonored. So after 2 years, you know, Absalom is a patient guy. I want you to see the offense that is committed against Absalom, not to justify what Absalom does in the next chapter, but to give context for it. And there are some cautionary warnings that we'll give at that point whenever we get there. So after 2 years, Absalom says, enough is enough. This is ridiculous. And so he sends word and says, Joab, I need you to come see me. Joab probably knows what this conversation is going to be about. I'm suspecting, again, that Joab and Absalom have talked before this, right? Joab, I need you to come see me. Joab ignores the summons. Sends again. Joab, I need you to come talk to me. Joab ignores the summons. Now, this is the kind of guy that Absalom is. Absalom says to his servants, you see the field on the other side of the fence? Barley in it? That's Joab's field. Go set that on fire. That'll get his attention. Yes. And it did. Joab shows up and says, what is going on? You set my field on fire. Absalom says, I called. He says, Joab, either bring me into the king's presence or I'm leaving. It would be better for me to be in exile. It would be better for me to be with my mother's family. I have shifted from a city of refuge in Geshur to a house of refuge in Jerusalem. And I'm not allowed to bump into Dad. I have to be careful that I don't go into the presence of Dad. I'm a prince, but I am a disgraced prince. No thanks. And so Joab, verse 33, went to the king and told him, and he summoned Absalom. So he came to the king and bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. There is the kiss of peace. There is the kiss of restoration, right? Kissing would be a standard form of greeting in the ancient world, but the king would not be kissing just anybody who comes to him, right? This is a significant kiss, right? It's restoring Absalom to his place of honor. That's all the time we've got tonight, so let me make an application, and then we'll close. When we, as the people of God, fail to act righteously, justly, and in timely, decisive ways, there are consequences. That does not in any way justify what Absalom is about to do. But it is the reality. It is the reality. That my sin can create situations and opportunities for other people to sin. And they remain responsible, but I have contributed to this. And one of the ways in which we can sin is through indecisiveness. Now, this is not arguing that we should be reckless, that we should be hasty, but it is recognizing that we cannot be paralyzed by indecision forever. And we cannot allow the stubborn, lingering guilt of our sins to create a situation in which we create injustice for other people. It's appropriate for us to look back at our lives and regret the sin of which we have been guilty. It is eminently appropriate for us to say, if I had it to do over again, I wouldn't. If you don't say that, you're arguably not repentant. But it's not appropriate to continue to be paralyzed by guilt. If you have repented, God has forgiven you, you got to stand up, dust off, and move on. Not forgetting the sin that God has pardoned you from, but recognizing that we cannot continue to look back, we have to press forward. And the fact that you and I are nothing but forgiven sinners does not change the fact that we are called to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God in the present day. David is not doing that. And we said last week, and we'll say again several times before we finish this story, David's great blind spot in his life is not women. David's great blind spot in his life is his family. He cannot say no. He cannot draw lines. He cannot enforce boundaries with his children. And it destroys his family as a result.